Okay, so I mentioned a moment ago, we are pursuing a chapter by chapter up to this point, the study of the book of Ecclesiastes. However, you might note if you look at chapter 6, there are only 12 verses in this chapter. That makes it the second shortest one in the whole book. There'll be another chapter 11, I think it is, or 10 maybe, that has only 10 verses. Just can look, chapter 11, okay, has only 10 verses. So really a short one here. And I think, man, that rather than just having the one chapter tonight, we'll probably get well into chapter 7 as well. What I'm noticing about this book of Ecclesiastes, and perhaps you picked up on this as well, is that while there is a single theme, it is a book on a topic. That topic is the futility of the physical life that we lead. It is not abandoning, of course, our spiritual life, and that spiritual life is all important and gives meaning to this life, and of course a future for all life. But the book is often described as somewhat dark because it is focusing on life under the sun and its futility. And so you will go through rather lengthy stretches where Solomon is just proclaiming all is vanity, it's striving after wind, and you know it all avails nothing, and then it all repeats over again. And so, rightly, it is sometimes rather heavy reading, recognizing that his ultimate goal is to help us to understand serving our God is above all else. It makes this life worth living, and that as grim sometimes as this life can be, it still is a thing that has its joys and its pleasures as well, which he'll describe for us from time to time. And so you have a book that is a cohesive book about that subject, life under the sun. But what you may have also noticed is that it's kind of like a cross between one of your Old Testament epistles, or excuse me, New Testament epistle, and the book of Proverbs. In that, Romans has, you know, very intricate reasoning all on one topic, chapter after chapter, so very clearly you can see where the author is going. Proverbs is kind of all chopped up with individual little statements of wisdom, and you don't try to read it like one extended argument or one extended discussion. And Ecclesiastes, for me, kind of falls in the middle. Because he's got that one discussion, and yet there are sections that don't even seem to have much connection at all. And particularly tonight, we're going to see that. As I go through it, I'm saying, okay, what verses should be collected together? They're on a common topic, so we're going to read these six verses, and then those four, and then those eight, you know, because each of those groups are clearly on one topic. And it got to where trying to do that outline tonight was very frustrating for me. Well, I'm not sure if this verse goes with that or goes with that or if it ought to, you know, just stand alone. And so things tonight will come sort of fitfully, if you will. And it just led me to wonder, this is the first time I had this thought, I was preparing for this class, is that Solomon probably did not sit down and write a whole book, but that more like the book of Proverbs is a collection of snippets of wisdom under the general topic of life under the sun and how vain that is and what we need to know to compensate for that darkness and that grimness so that we can lead happy, satisfying, successful lives. So you see what I mean here in a little bit, but if as you're reading ahead or looking ahead for what we're studying here in Ecclesiastes, you already read through this chapter, you might find, as I have, that it feels kind of disjointed sometimes. I'll show you what I mean in just a minute. Let's approach it first by reading chapter 6 down through chapter 7, verse 10, without interruption. Then we'll go back and see if we can identify these separate, you know, sub-ideas. So chapter 6 and verse 1. There is an evil which I've seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires, but God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many they be. But his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he doesn't even have a burial. I say, better the miscarriage than he. For it comes in futility and goes into obscurity, and its name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun, and it never knows. It is better off than he. Even if the man lives 1,000 years twice and does not enjoy good things, do not all go to one place. All a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have knowing to walk before the living? What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility and striving after wind. Whatever exists has already been named, and it is known what man is, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, the few years of his futile life? He will spend them like a shadow. For who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? A good name is better than a good ointment, and the day of death is better than the day of birth. It is better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man, and the living takes it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of pleasure. It is better to listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. And this too is futility. For oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. The end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit is better than haughtiness of spirit. Do not be eager in your hearts to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. Now, we'll stop there, because I counted the verses, and that's right in the middle of chapter 6 and 7. We add them together. But it's also got a logical stopping place, too. Now, as I've been saying before, you know, sometimes it feels a little bit disjointed to me, but really not in the first 6 verses. There's this evil Solomon wants us to know about. And it's an evil that he's seen a lot of. It's a prevalent evil among men. There's a man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, and his soul lacks nothing of all he desires, but God does not empower him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them, and this is vanity and severe affliction. Now, I think it's got the same man and the same concepts involved as we go farther there. But who is this guy? Who's this guy that Solomon now wants to introduce to us? Financially, he is he's wealthy, very well-to-do. Okay? And it sounds like, you know, the involvement of a foreigner, and I'm not sure what he means by a foreigner, that it would either have to do, perhaps, with the man's servants and slaves who were frequently captured in war, and so he would have foreigners that are enjoying everything that he's got, see, while he's worrying about it and not enjoying it. Okay? Or, you know, the foreigner might have to do with business relations in other countries, which we learned in our introduction to Solomon. He had quite a few of those going on. Hiram up in Tyre, you know, he had all these very big import businesses going on, export businesses as well, spices and various other commodities, and horses that he was buying and selling. And so, you know, we know that Solomon is perhaps describing himself, but in such a kingdom that is succeeding so well as America is today, you know, there'll be a lot of people
country that are involved with foreigners. Okay? So, how to define these foreigners, I'm not sure, but the idea is, whose name is on all the paperwork? Whose name is on the bank account? Whose name is on the deeds? The wealthy guy. Who's enjoying it all? Not him. Now, you know, how many of us have ever envied the rich people, you know, and Bill Gates and all the rest of them, you know, and Forbes puts out his richest list in America. I like to read it too, you know, and it amazes me how wealthy people are and who's the guy who's got more money than anybody else on the planet and all of that. But what do we know about any of their lives? See, really nothing. And what Solomon is saying is, he knew about their lives. He's the wealthiest one of them all, okay? And he's the guy who is responsible in his wisdom for the stability of the kingdom and its success economically in all the relations with their foreigners, whatever, you know, they might be. He's the guy that understands all this. And he is saying then, when you're envying that wealthy guy, what is a really grievous and prevalent thing? When you get that stuff, then what? It's miserable. It's just miserable. Now, obviously I don't know many movie stars, okay? And I'm not suggesting when I get done dealing with this that I know the one I'm about to mention any better than any others. But have you ever heard of Nicolas Cage? Okay, you all know who Nicolas Cage is. Done 1,000 movies, some of them pretty fun. Okay? Some of them, I guess, terrible. I haven't seen 10% of them probably, but you we all know who the guy is. Okay? We've also learned in the last couple of years what? And poor old Nick is about the worst handler of money anybody ever saw. Why, he had to sell more than one castle, I hear. He just started calling, whoa, a whole castle. You know, it's not even building one. Boats, they're going not boats and this kind of stuff, you know. And he just had terrible financial problems. And apparently part of the reason why he's got all of these movies out there is he's pretty desperate to get the financial act back together. Now, I'm not criticizing the guy, really. I don't know the man. And, you know, maybe he didn't have a thing in the world personally to do with any of it. Solomon's not blaming anybody here, and I'm not blaming Nick. So, Nick, you're listening to the tape, you know, let's still be friends. But, you know, what have we got? Is that, you know, it's not necessarily really great to live this lifestyle. And for those of us, you know, who don't have that lifestyle, Solomon at least is helping us to realize, you know, you might really be a whole lot better off where you are than to get caught up in this very prevalent evil, which is a, in the verse 2, severe affliction. Now, unless you think your life right now is a severe affliction, grievous, you know, then maybe we ought not spend so much time wishing we'd win that lottery that we never buy cake for. Somehow, that rich uncle we never learned about, you know, is going to drop all this money on us. So, in verse 3 now, I think he's continuing this thought, if a man fathers 100 children, now first off, that probably would not sound like a happy thing to us. And truth be told, I was done with two. Okay, that was plenty enough for me. But in those days, and in that culture, and in those times, when it came to children, what was true? More is better. See, and more was always better. And more was better for a wide variety of reasons, and it's not a culture that we're living in today. You know, and if we were living in that culture, we'd appreciate this maybe a lot more. But, you know, we've come to think that 2.5 is what it ought to be, and then you're irresponsible or something, you know. But in that culture, this is just to say that the guy had the best that could be known. And he lives many years, the verse continues. However many they be. But his soul is not satisfied with good things. He doesn't even have a burial. Then I say, better the miscarriage than he, for it comes in futility and goes into obscurity, and its name is covered in obscurity. Okay? Now again, picking on movie stars. Have you ever heard the name Mickey Rooney? Okay. Well, this week, I've got one of those TV systems that's so much fun. All I had had to do was type in Andy Hardy and click twice, and it got every Andy Hardy movie for me.
Okay,
so I'm working my way slowly through Andy Hardy movies. How do you know about Andy Hardy movies?
Okay.
Well, back in the late 30s and early 40s, there came to be, one last one in 58, 16 of them. Is Wikipedia great?
Okay, you learn these things.
And so now there are 16 of these movies, and at that time in the 40s, Mickey Rooney was the best, highest paid movie star there was. The guy was just so popular, too, you can't imagine. And he lived to be 88 years old. And when he died, how much money did he have? And where was he living? He had $18,000 to his name. And he was living at, I think it was a stepson's place, okay, in poverty. And immediately, the family started doing what? Squabbling and fighting and suing, you know, the whole thing was just a disaster. And it was just so sad. Okay? Now, doesn't even have a burial. I don't know that Solomon's saying the guy keels over a foreign land, you know, and his bones are bleached by the sun necessarily. But, you know, the idea might only be is that in the end, what did all of this wealth accomplish? Not even a decent burial. Okay? And that's just pretty well exactly what poor old Mickey Rooney suffered too. So, much as I love Andy Hardy movies and all that, I still think the American values they sell in those films, you know, ought to be shown to every kid in America, and Baltimore wouldn't burn it off if we had more Andy Hardy movies. You know, but ultimately, envying wealth is not a good idea, is it? And then in 4, he says, or at the end of 3, and really grim stuff, better the miscarriage than he, for it comes in futility and goes into obscurity. Its name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun and never knows anything, and it's better off than he is. Well, that's a downer, okay? But it sure makes the point, doesn't it? Better to have never lived at all than to suffer this grievous misfortune of being very wealthy and then discovering how really hard it is to actually enjoy it. Your servants might enjoy it. Your gardener gets to live, you know, on those grounds all day long and work on them. The servants are living in the house. They're enjoying the house while you're all over the world trying to make more money and pay the bills.
I'm wondering if rather than wealth and riches, if the key on all of this is all that he desires. Because every time he gets something, he desires something else. He desires more children.
The eye is not satisfied with seeing, and the ear with hearing. Remember those verses? See, so that very principle has been a part of this all the way through, and certainly, you know, belongs here as well. Okay, so now we come to 7, and it may be kind of changing the story a little bit here, you know, a separate kind of a thought, although it kind of comes back to the same idea in a minute. But he says, all a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. What did Carol just say? Exactly that. And 8, what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What's the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility and striving after wind. Now, I can't help it, you know, I'm just a human being, I guess. And so the events, current events, you know, color my preaching and my teaching are the things that, you know, we use to illustrate here. But, you know, the big deal this week, of course, is Ben Baldwin. We got all kinds of stuff going on over there, you know. So how did Freddie Gray get his spine 80% severed? I don't know. Today, another guy that was in the van with him, though separated by a partition so he couldn't see him, has gone on the record that Freddie was in there throwing himself around as if he was trying to injure himself, which prisoners do all the time, you know, so bad, they could sue the police, you know, for brutality and all the rest of that. Or maybe he's high on dope, he was known to sell drugs, you know, and he's out of his mind or whatever, you know, I don't know. But the city goes nuts, ostensibly because of police brutality, which may or may not have even happened, nobody knows. But the city goes nuts. And when it goes nuts, we saw everybody on the evening news, hundreds, if not thousands, of people doing what?
Looting
is the main thing, and destroying. Okay? Now, in looting, what is going on? It is theft. It is stealing. It is greed. It is hungering, you know, for those things that are not mine, but I think I want. Okay, now look at the verse again, particularly in verse 9. What the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. Is a way of saying what you have. See, what is in your possession, what you see, you own, is better than what? What you want. Okay? Now, yesterday, Baltimore ran amok. And when it did, it was because of that verse, wasn't it? People decided that their desire should be satisfied at the price of all of their own morality and character and legality, and they just threw off all constraints. And you look at these pictures and it's just horrifying. You know, they invaded the stores, then they went upstairs into the living quarters of the people that owned the stores and lived above the stores, and they ransacked the residences. They set fire, you know, the senior center was being built, you know, all this kind of stuff. And what was it all about? We're being oppressed. We don't have like everybody else. And then you listen to these reports, it's all about the poverty. It's all about how unfair that is. Okay, if you grant all of that, does it excuse letting your desires run amok? What would have been better for all those people, no matter how little they actually saw, what was better, what they had, than selling their souls to the devil to go behave like that? We're not animals. We shouldn't act like animals. Solomon's trying to get us to see this. But he says, this too is futility and striving after wind. Whatever exists has already been named. It is known what man is, for he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he is. Now you tell me what you think about that. But I'm thinking that in verse 10, the him who is stronger than he is God. It makes the most sense to me anyway. Whatever exists has already been named. Well, that's straight out of chapter 3 and before. There, you know, nothing new under the sun. We've seen it all before. It is known what man is because he cannot dispute with him that is stronger than he is. In other words, God has told us what the human experience is, what our strengths and our weaknesses are. God explained all of this, and there's no arguing with it. And the fact of the matter is, everything in the book, and especially what we're looking at in chapter 6, is all true. It's the way the world works. I've used that phrase so many times. Man is known, he can't dispute with the one that is stronger than he is, which I suspect is God. And then 11 and 12. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? Who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, the few years of his futile life? He'll spin them like a shadow. Who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? What do those verses say? It's real simple. You cannot foretell the future. Okay? So, who in Baltimore or anywhere else knows what will happen next? Suppose that all the demonstrators who behaved peacefully and the rioters who did not get what they want. The demonstrators get a whole bunch of police officers thrown in jail for murder. That's what they want. And apparently, many of them, without a trial, they've already decided, no evidence has been presented, nobody has a clue what actually happened, but you know, they want these guys hung. And so, okay, suppose they get it. Suppose that the looters all win the lottery tomorrow. Every one of them. They get $1 million each. Will it be better? Suppose that the looters had all run into jewelry stores, every one of them, and they each came out with hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they immediately sold them to their pensions. Now they're all independently wealthy. Will they be happier? Who knows? Okay? Mankind's ability to suppose that they can concoct this better world, and if it all turns out my way, it'll be better, is that necessarily so? No. So he talks about these many words and the futility, that increased futility. What I'm supposing he's saying there is, we've all got, you know, we can all expatiate in length in just thousands of words on the way things ought to be. Remember the title of that book? The way things ought to be. But if the way things are is the way things are in God's plan, and the way things ought to be is only what we conceive to be better in our limited understanding, there is no guarantee or even a hope that things would be better. Okay? Suppose, brethren, I mean, just suppose anything you want to name, people actually get. America becomes utopia. Healthcare is free. Everybody has $100,000 a year. If that's not enough, $200,000. Three, four, five. Suppose all of our wishes came true. Okay? Would it draw us closer to God? Would the first six verses suggest that we'd be any happier? Okay? Would it all turn out better in the end? How many of those stories have you read about those lottery winners who will say one after the other, not every one, some of them can handle money, but a very fair share of them, you know, I lost my children because of this. I lost my wife because of this. I wish that money had never come to me. Okay? Because they got what they wanted, bought the ticket, and won, and then watched their lives burn to the ground because they hadn't been prepared for it. They didn't know how to handle it. They weren't able to deal with it, and they were better off the way God had them before, you know, than now. So I think what it's all about, and grim as it is, it just all has to do with our sense of greed and the hubris that we can tell how things ought to be, you know, how to fix everything. Truth of the matter is, brethren, I don't think hardly any of us, you know, would be right in any of our conceptions about the way things ought to be. And too often, you know, we've seen people actually get what they want and it just sure doesn't work out. But here's a good thing. Chapter 7, verse 1. A good name is better than a good ointment. Ointments were very precious in that time. They were used for health and comfort, medicine. I mean, there's a wide variety of uses. They were also very expensive, you know, so if you're trading in them, you know, the hot commodity and all the rest of that, ointment in that very hot, dry culture, you know, was at the time just something of really, really valuable, you know, and if you had a supply of it, that was something. But a good name is better than that, and the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. Solomon is all about having all the experience of the whole world and then just reversing all of our expectations and cutting our legs off from underneath us and saying, you know, you've got everything backwards. It is better to die than to be born. It is better, as we're about to learn, be in the house of mourning than in the house of feasting. It is better to have a good name. Now, back to Baltimore. What happened to the name of Baltimore on Monday? Who wants to start a business in Baltimore? You know? So now that all these stores are gone and residences destroyed and services like this upcoming home and everything, you know, wiped out, who thinks they want to go in there and invest more? I saw one report this afternoon found very interesting. They said, well, these riots were just nothing like 1968 when Martin Luther King died. But look at these neighborhoods. And they panned the camera around, you know, and they were doing their report. Said, you see all this? Those were not areas that were part of the rioting on Monday. But you see how the windows were all broken out? And you see how, you know, dilapidated everything is? Been that way since 1968 because this neighborhood never recovered from those riots. And it's been 50 years. Now they're doing it again. Okay? And what happened to Baltimore's name? Shot through and through. What happened to the names of these individual people who will eventually be arrested by the police? Thanks for the wonders of all the TV, but camera technologies we've got. Police said, you know, we're just searching all the security cameras. We're going to catch a lot of these guys. Now they're going to have police records. What happens? Then that cycle begins. Who wants to hire a guy with a record for thievery and vandalism? You want to hire that guy? Can you trust him? See, we perpetuate this whole thing all over again. What matters above vast wealth? What matters above having everything your soul desires? What matters? Your character, your personality, and the reputation that you have. Your reputation is more valuable than absolutely any of these things. Being known for your honesty, being known for your integrity, being known for your faith, being known for all the virtues that we call the fruits of the Spirit, thanks to Paul's letter to Galatians, and every other quality that God has ever asked his people to acquire and to practice. You get a name for that, and you are truly wealthy. So for me, you know, chapter breaks are kind of arbitrary here. This is probably the summary of chapter 6. All the rest of that stuff availed nothing. What matters, good name. It is better, verse 2, now we've got a clear section, to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting, because that is the end of every man. And the living takes it to heart. Sorrow's better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. The mind of the wise is in the house of mourning, while the mind of fools is in the house of feasting. Now, house of mourning, of course, would be, in everybody's culture, I guess, that place where you go for funerals and memorials. And so, when you go there, you are only there for one reason. Somebody is no longer experiencing life under the sun. Somebody now has passed into a new circumstance, world, and condition. They don't have any of these concerns down here anymore. But we love them. We miss them. We're aching because we have lost something. Solomon says, yes. But at the end of verse 1, the day of death is better than the day of birth. At the day of death is all your travail and all the striving for the money and keeping the body healthy and hoping the kids turn out well, you know, and all that stuff. At the day of your death, how much do you worry about that anymore? Yeah. But from very early on in life, you're just facing all that stuff and you're going to spend a whole life worrying about that stuff. And so, better to be at the end with it over. And then, for us who are left behind, verse 2, better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting. It's the end of every man. The living takes it to heart. What is Solomon saying? We need a reality check every so often. And we get it whenever anybody dies and we go to the funeral. We get the wake-up call. And that call says what? One of these days it'll be for you. What do you think about that? What are you doing about that? There is an absolute inevitability. It cannot be stopped. It cannot be changed. One day, that funeral is for you. What are you going to do about that? Well, the good name, which represents your character, is up ahead. And then, you know, we are learning here in verse 3, sorrow better than laughter, for when a face is sad, a heart may be happy. That verse has driven me crazy for the longest time. I'm not sure I understand it at all. Jerry, tell me what it means.
I'm not sure either.
All right! All right, I want Jerry to give me a dollar every time I stump him. That's it, up there? Okay. You got anything at all, Jerry? So that's the way I feel. I look at it and I say, well, yeah, but... Jimmy's got it. And that may be it, and that's the best I've ever been able to come up with. Okay, but I've also noticed, and this is not to try to shoot the idea down, it's just, I'm just trying to understand it. When people do go to the house of mourning, what have you noticed you'll see a lot of? Laughter. And it's very nervous, okay? It's also very real, and it's not inappropriate at all. It is necessary, really, to help compensate for the circumstances that we're in. When I was very young, I just thought, well, these people, you know, this is just wrong. They shouldn't stand around before and after and be laughing like that. You know, we should just be really grim and all. And then as the years went by, I began to realize they really need that release. They really need that help. And so then I just wondered, though, it does seem to me that when my heart is sad, I can put on a front and I might even laugh, you know, for real. Because I need a balance. And when my heart is happy, though, can I not also, when I'm laughing, also be concealing its sadness? So it seems to me like there is a way that it might work both ways, and not just one. And so then I'm back, Jimmy, to square one again. Oh, okay. Okay. But Ted has the absolute answer. Great point. Had a real good friend in high school and never talked to him again for over 40 years. And then suddenly he popped up on my radar again, and now we've resumed a relationship, you know, by phone. He's down in California. But I have learned that in those 40 years, that's exactly what happened to him. And first it was his mother, and he never left the house except to buy groceries and medical supplies for her for years and years. Never went to a movie. Never, ever, you know, did anything but care for her, because she needed 100% care, and they couldn't afford anything but him to do it. And when she died, his stepfather took her place. He was already sick, and that's why he was involved in it, and he went right on for 8 more years doing nothing but live in the house and care for his stepfather until he died. Okay? Same thing. And when I talked to him, it's really interesting, because truly, it's like he had just stepped out of a prison cell. He was unfamiliar with CD players and cell phones. He was uncomfortable with them. These were not things that he'd ever known or had a use for. His entire life had been focused in the care of that individual. He was living in that home, and he went a couple blocks down to Safeway and back, CVS, and that was it. Okay, and so great load is lifted. Great point. So here now, you know, there's release and relief. And again, what is Solomon doing? Kind of reversing all of our understanding and expectation to realize that what we think as being as horrible and terrible can be best thing, you know, coming. So got to be careful what we think. Got to be careful what we say. Now, starting in 4. Yeah, I'm sorry. I missed about a year ago.
Part of the uncertainty on it. But one thing that strikes me is that in the house of mourning, there is a time of reflection and seriousness and realization of how tenuous life is, and it is therefore a time when people's attention can be fixed upon what really counts, and that's spiritual issues. That's one of the things that's very common in our time, and I do not fault it, but that is looking upon the passing of one and the period of mourning as in fact a celebration of life, and we're very, very used to the idea that a memorial service is just that, it's a celebration of life. And I don't fault that. I'm not saying that's wrong. But what I am saying is that for people who are out of Christ, looking back on the person's life is the only way they can look.
Mm-hmm.
For the one who is in Christ, the service is more than a celebration of life. It is a celebration of victory looking forward.
Yeah.
And to me, that is the value of speaking at a funeral service, a memorial service. While there is great mourning, there is also an opportunity to help people see that there must be preparation made for what lies ahead. There is more to life than what lies behind.
Amen. And that's the living take it to heart, isn't it? There it's in the verse 2. Okay. Carol. Yeah, one is only possibility, the other is the fruit of that life. Okay, another passage that just kind of confuses me for its location and the fact that verse 7 begins, you know, with the word for, F-O-R. So, you know, I get 5 and 6, better listen to the rebuke of a wise man than for one to listen to the song of fools. And doesn't need any explanation. As the crackling of thorn bushes under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This too is futility. Yeah, that's right. And it's why I have a hard time even watching late night comedy shows, Letterman and that kind of stuff. It's just all about the laughter of fools. It's like they're listening to, you know, crackling thorns. And all futility, and much of it, you know, obscene, so why do you want to listen anyway? But then why does 7 start with 4? For oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Yeah, laughter is empty and useless, but... For oppression makes a wise man mad, and a bribe corrupts the heart. I don't know why that's there. But I can read on and say, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. Patience of spirit, which might have to do with the oppression and maybe the bribery and resisting those things, is better than haughtiness of spirit, which leads people to be oppressive and to accept bribes. So, you know, connections there. But then in 9, do not be angry, eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. And that's another reason we'll wind up back in Baltimore. You know, it's just this madness of anger and frustration. And I've listened to one commentator after another say how they understand that, and they can appreciate that, and we need to respect that this is a justifiable anger. And I can't help but think, well, no, it's not. I understand that if you're living in poverty, you don't like it, and you want to, you know, better yourself and all the rest of that. But there is no way to justify anger that is sin. That is destructive, that threatens lives. We've got one individual who is in the hospital in critical care because their home was set on fire.
they have to do with this Freddie Gray? What did they have to do with, you know, the oppression, you know, and economic oppression? What did they have to do with any of that? Nothing. And so you're caught up here in a madness of rage. And when people, and we learned this from the Proverbs, are in the presence of angry people. You remember what the Proverbs said? You want to stay away from angry people, lest what? You learn to be angry. Okay? Now, the propaganda and the perpetuation of those problems that we've seen in the last couple of days via the media, talking about this anger all the time and how justified it is and how terrible the police are and all of that, is any of that helping our problem? No! We all want justice. But feeding on resentment and bitterness and hostility and anger to reaches the point of a maniacal rage that runs amok to just do indiscriminate evil to everybody, and mostly the people who are sharing the same unhappy circumstances, is just an outrage, and it's insanity. And so Solomon is just saying, look, don't be eager in your heart to be angry. Anger resides in the bosom of fools. Now Solomon's told us a lot about injustice, and in verse 7, he just did. And he's not justifying injustice, he's not trying to excuse it, he's certainly not trying to perpetuate it. But he is trying to get us to understand that whether an anger is justifiable because of an actual injustice or not, what did the Ephesian letter tell us? Be ye angry and sin not. And that's what equation broke down in Baltimore, didn't it? So he got angry, and then what? Sin, you know, took over the city. She was too. I think her name is Toya Graham, is that right? Seen that video too, and I have real mixed emotions about that one. On the Monday before that happened, had anybody taken a video of her doing that, where would she have spent the night? In jail for what?
Child
abuse. You know, the kid might have been taken off the Child Protective Services, she'd never seen him again. But in the light of a riot, suddenly she looks what? They're all calling her what? Yeah, Mother of the Year. And I forget who it was. One of the commentators said she ought to be on the cover of Time magazine for Person of the Year. And I'm going, well, no, apparently your whole program had already failed. And she may just be practicing more of it now that we're catching on film, and it didn't work to begin with. So I'm not real sure that she's much of a role model. But you do have to appreciate the fact that at least she was trying to restrain the kid, whether she's doing it rightly or wrong. You know, I don't know. But that was an interesting deal, to say the least.
If we go back to chapter 4, verse 1, it discusses the oppressors and their power and how the people have no comfort.
Mm-hmm. That's it. See, that's it. And Solomon said so in chapter 4. If you had to skip back, look at it. It's not just the first verse either, you know, the next couple. So you're reading about this, and it was breaking Solomon's heart. It's tearing him apart, and it's in his own kingdom. Okay? The poor you will have with you always. We cannot win that war, but we want to do the best we can with it. We're going to try to, you know, wage that battle and do the best that we can, but it'll never be eradicated. And so ultimately, you're absolutely right. It's all I'm going to say. You get to this point where it's just the most awful thing. You can't do anything about it. So you burn the city down. Well, now, oops, that's doing something about it, isn't it? And it's not the right thing either.
Now, I want to make sure, I've only got a couple of minutes left, that we get to verse 10, though, because it's just the perfect summary to this whole discussion in the Baltimore thing, too. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. Okay?
Now, yesterday, just before I went to that Edges/Lutheran study, I went over to see Lucille Gladys. Now, Lucille's exactly 30 years older than I am. She's 93. Said, Lucille, you know, I can remember my first riot pretty well. It was 1965, it was Watts, and I was living just there in the L.A. area, and we could see the smoke, and it scared us. I remember being 13 and scared. What does that mean? The city's on fire. I see the smoke. You know, is it coming this way? I mean, truly scared. We went to Wattsburg. And, of course, that was the first riot that the United States had ever had, right? Asking Lucille, do you remember riots? Oh, yeah, well, there was that zoot suit thing. Also in Los Angeles. You guys heard that? Go on, Wikipedia's great. Look up zoot suit wars. But anyway, and then as she and I were sitting there, we're going back, and, well, what do you know? There's nothing new under the sun. And, of course, America is the only country where this happens, too, right? Well, it happens in every country, you know, on Earth. And whenever something like Baltimore happens, what do we all say? Well, things were sure a lot better before now. I mean, the whole world is just burning down. You know, it's just worse than ever. I've never seen anything like this. What is the whole book of Ecclesiastes about? Well, if you think you've never seen anything like this, then take your head out of the sand. Where are you living? Why don't you open your eyes? This is all there's ever been, and this is all there will ever be. And don't you say things were better back then. Because when you do, what have you just made of yourself? A fool. Okay? Now, is that to say that there has never been times or places where things were better and then things were worse, and things were in the middle? Is that to say that everything is always exactly the same? No. Can countries get better and get worse morally?
Yes.
And they do. And the scriptures talk about it. Okay? He's not saying that. He's just saying that when you get all wistful for the days gone by that were so perfect, that's pretty foolish. Because if you really think about those days gone by, what was going on then? The same things that are going on now. And so we as human beings have this tendency to think that everything was so much better back then. I'll give you one reason and I'll let you go for tonight. Why is it that we all have this sense that things were so much better in the days of yore?
Because they weren't televised.
Well, okay, but 3,000 years ago when Solomon wrote the book of Ecclesiastes, he didn't have those things either. You know, it's not that. It's not advertisement. Okay, I suspect that what it is for the first about 18 years of your life, who pays all the bills? Who keeps you safe? Who feeds you and clothes you and houses you? And you do live for a period of time in paradise. What's your biggest problem? The math test. Okay. And then you get out in the real world and suddenly, oh, for the good old days. See? I suspect that's partly what's involved here is we spend the first few decades of our life not having to be responsible. And in those days, having relatively very few problems. So, Sam or Carol, one of the two, was talking about having their whole life is before them. Oh, I feel so bad for them. Oh, that's too bad. Oh, no. I'm so glad I'm getting to the end. Oh, I don't want to do that again. Okay. So that's one of my favorite verses right here, is when we're reading chapter 6 and all is lost and it's grim and horrible and we just want to curl up in a ball, you know, and go catatonic. So I'm going to sing, hey, guess what? It's just always going to be this way, and that's what you have to learn to deal with. So get over it. What Solomon's been saying for 3,000 years.
Go.
I think our memory put rose-colored glasses on lots of things.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, just the way you remember it, and you don't want to see the bad things, so you push them out to the edge, and pretty soon somebody who beat somebody their whole life, when they die, they're just absolutely horrified that, you know, this wonderful man that they were with has died, and yet everybody knows how much he hurt her. You know, I mean, it's things like that, that it's the rose-colored glasses in order to survive.
Profound wisdom of the nun. It is what it is. And don't worry.
Be happy.
John Oglesby, would you lead us in prayer, please?
To the microphone, please. Thank you.